Hey everyone, Ronan here. You're listening to a Good Long podcast, Lessons for a Good Long Life. The conversation you're about to hear was recorded back in December, right before I started reimagining what this podcast could be. But I think the content is absolutely relevant to what it is to live a good long life. It's a conversation with Dr. Sherry Walling. Sherry is a clinical psychologist, speaker, podcaster, award-winning and best-selling author, yoga teacher, and mental health advocate. Her company, Zen Founder, provides mental wellness resources to leaders and entrepreneurs as they navigate transition, loss, conflict, or any manner of complex human experience. In recognition of the title of this episode, she is also the co-author with her husband, Rob Walling, on a book called The Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together, as well as the recently published and very moving book, Touching Two Worlds, A Guide for Finding Hope in the Landscape of Loss, which chronicles Sherry's experience of grieving for her father and her brother, who both died, her father of cancer and her brother from suicide, within 6 months of each other. This conversation is a wonderful reminder that whether it's business or life or loss, we're all just trying to keep our shit together most of the time. So be kind to each other. I hope this conversation touches you as much as it touched me. A lot of what I've been talking about and posting about lately has been about transitions and finding new depth of meaning when you realize that the things you've been working for may not have been all that they've cracked up to be. So my guess is that somewhere along those lines and finding new purpose may have been along those lines as well.
So yeah, that sounds right up my alley. I'm in the middle of like a few transitions just in my own world.
Can I put on the psychologist hat and
for sure
be patient? Let's
go. Let's train. Yeah, I mean, one is like sending a kid to college. My oldest child started college this fall, and our holiday tree is sitting in the living room undecorated, just naked, and it's been there for like a week and a half because one of my sons is 13. Okay. One of my sons is away at school. And nobody cares. I'm like, I don't know if I want to decorate this tree. So it's just this like visceral reminder of the transformation of, you know, 5 years ago being someone with like small children at home and doing the Christmas cookies and the whole deal. And now it's like, we're not doing that anymore.
And that great ruse we run on kids for years and years. Oh, yes, Santa is real. Yes, that naughty list. Yeah. You better be careful, else you end up, actually, my four-year-old is now proudly declared himself to be on the naughty list. He's like, I'm on the naughty list.
I kind of like that style. That's sort of the list I might go for myself personally.
Truthfully, you're screwed when that happens because you're like, now
I have nothing to threaten you with. No leverage. No fear.
Yeah. Honestly, kids are terrorists. I've realized that. Like they embody all the characteristics of terrorism because they threaten, you can threaten them all they want and they don't give a shit. And you're left, you know, you just left negotiating with terrorists because they're going to do whatever the hell they want anyway. So,
and that's the scenario in which you've loved them well enough for them to not be very afraid of you.
That I think they should be a little bit afraid of this. I think a little bit of fear is good. A reminder that not everything is as friendly as your parents. But I totally hear you. So how has the transition been? I mean, my wife, Stephanie, she has two older kids, and both is finishing university and, who started last year, and she's got a 7 and a 4-year-old with me. So she's really stuck in the middle. But I know she found that tradition when, not the tradition, the transition to the kids leaving to be a lot more challenging than she expected. How have you found it?
For the most part, I've enjoyed it. I think there's a little bit of a gift in teenagers in that by the time it's go time, you're kind of ready. Like it felt like as we were moving him down, I'm like, this is the best strategy for us to still really love each other is that you don't live with me anymore. Cause if you continue to live with me, that's probably going to go sour here sometime soon. What is a little bit more challenging is that we do have one kiddo left at home. Yep. And both my husband and I are kind of like, ooh, we feel a lot of freedom. We have a lot less parenting responsibility, but yet we do have one at home. So we can't like fully go for it.
Yeah.
And so the adjustment to a family of three We were actually a family of five. We had a little girl living with us for 4 years. So we had three kids. We bought a house with three kids and like kind of set up life for raising three children. And now we're just left with this one like grumpy 13-year-old in our house. And that feels super weird. Like, where does our energy go? He doesn't want all of our parental attention. We're like overparenting him, hovering. But yet we're not quite done. We can't cross the finish line and, you know, stay out partying all night. So
yeah, we're too old to stay out partying out all night.
That's
anyway.
True.
Let's be honest.
Thank you for telling the truth about that. It's just a fantasy that lives in the back of my head. It's not really real.
We're at, what's it called? The double, right? That face of the soul where you can either go down the path of the midlife crisis or the midlife awakening, and the choice is yours. But fortunately,
but is there any awakening without crisis, Ronan?
I think so. I mean, I think that the narrative of what Erwin, the teacher I work with, is all about, which is like, things don't have to be hard. We glorify struggle in our society, and we undervalue ease. We significantly undervalue ease. And what if we start to reorient ourselves to valuing ease as much as anything else? Really become a huge shift in our, in our society, I think quite a bit, right? Like if you think about it, the things that come easy, we should appreciate the most, be like, oh, fuck, that was magical. But for some reason we don't. Yeah. I'm like, I need to struggle for this to make it feel like it's worthwhile. And it's really nonsensical.
I think the one thing though that I've observed in human development, whether it's raising children or even watching adults, is like, as you're edging towards that place of the next big growth, there is some disruption in your capacity and in your system. So if we think about a kid who's getting ready to walk, there's like the crawling and then the weird waddling on your hands and feet. And there's all of these like sort of jagged approaching the next skill, that zone of proximal development, as Zavlogosky calls it. And it's messy. It's this messy middle before there's this sort of like easing into, now I can walk, now I can drive, now I am an expert in my field after this messy struggle for a while.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think there's a learning curve for sure, but it doesn't have to be hard per se, right? And I don't think, specifically speaking as what people would describe, although I would challenge mature adults, you know, the things that we encounter, like the midlife crisis or the midlife awakening, it doesn't have to be filled with struggle. You know, Aaron gives the example of like, just because you woke up every day of your life and ate Cheerios for breakfast, and one day you decided that you don't want to eat Cheerios anymore, there's going to be a part of you being like, oh shit, I've been doing it for so long. This change feels threatening, but it really is as easy as going to the cupboard and taking out a different box of cereal, right? It really is that easy. Yeah. We just like to attach a whole bunch of potentially, I guess, unnecessary meaning to things for whatever reasons. But I do also take your point, and it's not so, I think, germane to a child walking, but there is a lot of dread that comes with change. You know, that sense of who you were, not being who you're becoming, and having to let go of those identities, right?
I think our society is so confused, though. We're afraid of bliss. We're afraid of ease. We're uncomfortable with that. I'll totally sign on that with you. But I think we also don't grieve well. We don't go into the depths well. And I see a lot of both and, you know, my recent book is called Touching Two Worlds, which talks about like being in the depths of grief. And it's really from those depths that we know true joy, or that we really appreciate ease when it's available. So I get curious about how crisis does birth that next phase of development, that next competence, or how ease only really comes from some sense of struggle. I think you're right. We glorify struggle, but we also really avoid it in a way that we're not really going into it.
I think we avoid intensity. I certainly avoid intensity, like my whole
stay
life
in the middle, stay safe,
keep it tight. You know,
yeah.
I remember, like, I don't think I was inspired by it, but I remember this moment in The Simpsons where when Lisa Simpson was like, "Dad, we're part of the MTV generation. We feel neither highs nor lows." And Homer's like, "How does that feel?" And she's like, "Meh." Right. And then I remember as a kid, you know, my childhood was tumultuous for all sorts of reasons, which I'm happy to share. Not as tumultuous as some, but certainly it had its fair degree of tumult. But I remember at one point just being like, fuck this. I'm just going to be an even keel. I'm not going to let anything rock me. Why would I let anything break my stride? And I actually really like that song. I forget what it's called, but ain't nobody going to break my stride. Mm. Ain't nobody going to hold me down. And that's how I lived my life for a long time until actually I met Erwin. And we had our first session together. I was in a relationship. I was 27 or 28 at the time. And he's like, "Ronan, the decision about whether to stay in a relationship or not is wholly dependent on emotions." And he's like, "You've spent your whole life avoiding emotion. So you can't make an emotional decision rationally. Logic and emotion don't transcend each other. Like, they're totally separate fields. So you got to learn how to learn how to feel your emotions." And I'm like, fuck.
I'd rather not. What are my other choices?
Logic
What's
works.
Option B?
Yeah. Logic works really. It's worked really well to this point. Mm-hmm. And so like my life since then has been trying to expand my capacity for emotion, which by necessity means feeling intensity. And I think that's one of the things that certainly for me, although it crosses over, too far when we're talking about 5-MeO-DMT. Excuse me for that. That's one of the things that I liked about psychedelics is it forces you to feel intensely. And I think that's what a lot of people like about psychedelics is that there's like a level of intensity of emotion that you feel that we don't let ourselves feel otherwise.
And we're inhibited in our capacity to stop it or to modulate it through our prefrontal cortex. Temporarily inhibited. But some of us need that the guardrails to be just taken off to say, no, you can't stop this. You're going all the way in. We do that with consent. We do it with safety. We do it with the guide. But that's what we're doing when we do a psychedelic experience, is saying, let's go to the depths.
Yep. Yeah. Interesting. All right. So let's talk about you. Unless there's other transitions you want to talk about right now before we go into talking about your story and your book, we can always start with the end and work backwards. There's nothing wrong with that. Not typical for a podcast. So what other transitions are you going through right now?
Well, I'm writing the next book that I'm working on is about people leaving their companies, exiting their companies. So I think a lot about our relationship with the thing that we're making in the world, especially as entrepreneurs, and what happens when that ends, whether we want it to end or it ends for reasons outside of our control. Yeah. I think that's a pretty important and unique psychological process that we don't always give a lot of thought to how to do that well. So I'm working on that.
All right. Well, I'm handing the clinical psychologist hat back to you. Talk more about that because I think, you know, what I've been going through, like I don't know if you tracked, but like field trip filed for restructuring in March and that's when I left. And so that's pretty much defined. I guess it's been almost 9 months now. It has defined the last 9 months. It's been something. But I'm curious to know
what surprised you about it? I'm curious.
First the sense of relief, like the first week after, because like it had been a long time coming, you know, I'd seen the writing on the wall for quite some time and every day showing up to work was like trying to push against a slow moving train wreck, knowing that you'll never be able to stop it barring some sort of miracle, but you got to put your shoulder into it every single day. So as soon as, you know, I left, which was on March 23rd, the next couple of days were filled with a little bit of anxiety because I'm like, oh shit, like I got to figure out a way to make income and all that kind of stuff. Even though like financially we're okay. It wasn't actually that urgent, but it had been such a dogmatic piece of my mind about making money and all that kind of stuff that, you know, having the absence of income, which was like really the first time in my life, was a little bit scary. But otherwise it was just a sense of relief that I no longer had to bear the burden of trying to stop that slow moving train wreck. Mm-hmm. Then what surprised me was the dead cat bounce, which I had terrible brain fog,
come over me for a good 3 or 4 months afterwards. And I think the best sense I could make is it was just all the stress that I'd been holding on to and, you know, just absorbing, trying to make all of this happen and try and create, you know, change the outcome and make people feel as good as possible in the circumstances, whether you're an investor or an employee or anything along those lines, until we passed the point of no return. And so that was exhausting. But I had no idea. Like, I've been all my life, I've been pretty, had a pretty high capacity for absorbing stress. And it never had gotten me that bad. And this time it was a wallop. And maybe it's just because I'm getting old, but I think also the degree of intensity was much higher than I was willing to let on. And then just trying to reorient because it really did feel like field trip. And what we were doing was so well suited for what I wanted. I was going to say what I thought I wanted, but I will say what I wanted. It was fun, interesting. It was unconventional. You know, it got a lot of attention. Certainly there was a financial interest because, you know, the company at one point was worth $600 or $700 million. And then all of that goes away. You know, my identity as a leader in this, what I think is going to still be a very important space, kind of disappears. And I'm like, okay, who am I? Oh, you know, now, okay, I'm an entrepreneur, but I'm also, and I know there's a lot of loadedness in this expression, but now I'm a failed entrepreneur. And, you know, do I even care about money that much? I think I do. Maybe I don't. You know, do I want to spend my time starting a new business? It sounds really fucking terrible to try and put my shoulder into something again like that. And all for what, you know? And it was something I had realized from the sale of our previous business, Canadian Cannabis Clinics, is that, like, you have an exit, you make a bit of money, and you realize that all the problems that you thought would go away when you achieve success are all still there with you, but you no longer have that dream or that thing to chase that distracts you from the reality of the problems have nothing to do with the thing you're chasing and won't be solved by them. And so you're left with a double whammy of being stuck with all your problems and not having a way to distract
and
yourself.
And no wonderful, healthy distraction.
And no wonderful, healthy distraction.
And
just exploring how you pick up the pieces from that. I don't know. That sounds like that's very relevant to what you're talking about. So I'll stop there, but feel free to ask more specific questions if you want to.
No, I think you did a nice job of articulating like what it feels like when there's all this momentum and then the train stops, but like the cargo keeps going and it kind of like crashes over you. You know, one of the things that I think about it, I guess more clinically, is like it really looks and feels sort of like a postpartum depression, right? The thing that you wanted, that you built, that you incubated, it's happened, you know, even in the case of an exit that's lucrative, as was your first round. It's happened, here you are, but oh my gosh, it's so much harder than you expected. And there is that sense of listless aloneness with yourself and your thoughts. And folks who are entrepreneurs are just, they have this wonderful capacity for brains that go fast and do lots of things and are always creating and generating and making and making and making and do not, just categorically, do not do well with open space. And so the amount of like lostness or depression, the sort of increase in substance abuse that I see right in the first sort of 6 months after someone has ended a company or exited a company is like, whew, got to pay attention to that because people are super, super vulnerable in that spot. And I don't think they realize that. I don't think they know that.
Yeah. No, there's a huge loss of identity, whether it's through success or failure. You know, and I ascribe it particularly to men, although it's certainly not limited, but like men are doers, right? That's what we're born into society. We're the providers, so to speak, in the traditional sense. And as much as we like to be modern and open-minded and gender neutral, the fact is like we've been programmed that men do, right? Like that. And if you're not doing, then you're not really worthwhile in society, you know? And there's lots of ways that that gets expressed. And so, you know, and it's one of the things that I've in particular struggled with. And I think one of the most well-received conversations I've had on this podcast was with Scott Galloway, you know, Prof. G. Scott Galloway. And he came on. This is a guy who's had tremendous successes, fair share of failures. But we kind of drilled down to the point where he's like, listen, Ronan, I know I have lots of money. I have all the benefits that economic security provide. I have a beautiful wife. I have healthy kids. I should be a 10 out of 10 happiness. And at the end of the day, if whatever's happening in my professional life feels like it's going sideways, that dominates my mood. Period. It's like, it shouldn't matter, but that is the one thing that matters more than anything in my mood. And I don't know what to do about it. And I think that's a very real struggle for a lot of people.
Entrepreneurship is like this really deep expression of selfhood. Like, sure, our relationships are, our children are, but they're separate entities. And a business is kind of, right? It really is this expression of our ideas, our creative mindset, what we can think and make and bring into the world. And if it's not going well, or if we lose it, or if it falls apart, it's almost impossible not to have some sense of self or identity crumble alongside of it.
Totally. And it invites the real question, which is like, why am I not enough? Right? That's the real question. It's like, somehow I am only enough when I bring something else into the world. And I know, like, being part of MMT, where it's not as bad, but other entrepreneurial organizations I've been in, I sit there and like, all people talk about is their business. Like, their business is their identity, to the point where I almost, and as much as I can, I don't refer to myself as an entrepreneur, because there's like, there's something weird. Like, when you see that happening too much, that like, your business is your identity, is your life. It's like, no, it's just a business, and there's a lot more to you. I hope, well, there is, maybe you don't see it, than just your business. But it becomes all consuming, right? Mm-hmm.
And super psychologically dangerous, and also super gratifying. It's a very both and experience. I've been really loving Rick Rubin's book, The Creative Act.
Yeah.
And I think just really thinking about, part of our core human drive is to create and to bring something of ourselves out in the space outside of us. And for many of us, that's a business, right? It's this ultimate creative act. And I live in a lot of celebration of that, and see how great it is for people when it works, when they get to do it. But also, when you tie your heart, soul, mind, your inner well-being to this thing that then lives out in the universe, that's vulnerable to markets and wars and all kinds of shit you can't control, you're sort of, you know, tying a string between your innermost well-being and the wild chaos of the world, and it makes you very vulnerable.
Yep. So, tell me more about the book. What are the insights you are planning to share, if you don't mind?
The new book. The book that's coming.
We'll get to the previous book too, because I'm very interested in it.
I think one of the things that feels really important for people who are in the middle of those big transitional processes is just the normalizing of the difficulty. You know, I think a lot of folks are, again, especially in the case where everything has gone right and they're walking away with $50 million or whatever it is, like, great outcome, and they're still miserable. And they're like, what does this mean? Didn't see this coming. And so I want to give people a framework for like, yeah, that's probably going to happen. Here's why. Here's how to have your eyes open about it. Here's what to do about it. I think there's a whole section too on really holding that question of, what do I do next? I think that's a question that like really lives in our bellies. And right at the beginning of even sort of thoughts about a transition, we begin to think, well, what's the next move? What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And I really love the idea of some intentional spaciousness around that question. Not for forever, but really allowing a period of sabbatical, a period of rest and intentional exploration, so that people feel like they can use their time well, but are not, you know, just golfing or whatever sort of stereotype we have about like the retired person.
Right. That's fair. It's one of the things, I mean, it's, excuse me. An unnamed listener was listening to an unnamed episode with a guy who's achieved a degree of success, and he just kind of tuned in at the wrong moment to the episode. And he was like, here's this guy who has all sorts of privilege and success, and all he's doing is complaining about how hard it is to have a kid. Now he subsequently listened to the rest of the episode and realized that there was a lot more to the conversation, than he had initially tuned into, and his opinion changed quite rapidly. But there is still that stigma of, like, it's like Scott Galloway being like, I got everything. And most people listening to it would be probably like, here's a rich white guy complaining about, like, his life. And it's kind of like a little bit of shut the fuck up. You've got nothing to complain about. And so actually giving yourself space to feel that. And I think it's true. It's a level of compassion that we need to feel for all people. And I think it's really been lost in many ways in our society. It's like all people struggle, even if they don't have financial struggles. We all have emotional struggles. That's just part of, I think, the process of being human. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of compassion for that left in the world. And those people who are experiencing it are kind of like, they become self-critical, being like, I know I should be happy. What the fuck is wrong with me?
Right. I should be okay.
Yeah.
And I can absolutely appreciate, like, the kind of how yucky it feels to hear privileged, well-fed, well-traveled humans talking about how hard things are. And also, you know, I'm a psychologist. Like, I take care of people when they fall apart. And there are plenty of folk who are in that liminal space, that transition, who are dying. I mean, who are ending their lives, whether it's by suicide or substance abuse or heart attacks. I mean, people are imploding. And in particular, I think that entrepreneurs are folk we really need in our society. We need their ideas. We need their drive. We need their capacity to make things and move sort of the economy and the well-being of the world forward. And this isn't work that's just like, oh, let's not make you feel sad. For me, this is work that's like, let's help you stay alive and stay contributing. So that's really, I mean, the framework that I come from in my work.
Yeah. How did you... I'll say fall, even though it may not be the right word. How did you fall into this line of work in particular? Was it because Rob is an entrepreneur, or was it something you were attracted to in the first place?
It's a little bit. I started in my life as a clinical psychologist, working with people who had trauma or high levels of intense stress in their jobs. So lots of first responders, ER doctors, people in the military. So I had this sort of like funky specialty that was an intersection between trauma and someone's relationship with their vocation. So given how important our vocation is to us when trauma happens in the context of our work, like, just a tricky thing to navigate, to say the least. And so I was doing this work and then was married to a tech startup entrepreneur. So the people in my living room in the evenings were other tech startup folks. And I heard some of the same just struggles around the brutality of the relationship they were having with their businesses that I was hearing from my clients in the clinic. But really, I think the tipping point for me was when Aaron Schwartz died by suicide. He was one of the sort of young, brilliant founders of Reddit, among other things, and just represented this kind of like amazing mind, like this driving ethic, just sort of the best of us. And as a young man, just could not sort of make his way through the challenges that he was experiencing. So I came home from work one day and found my husband, who's like, you know, a double engineering, like as logical as they come. He's crying in the office about Aaron Schwartz's death and what that means for him and for his friends and for our kids and for all of the sort of brilliant minds who can't quite land the plane in the world.
Interesting.
That is how it began. Started a podcast, started giving talks, wrote a book, et cetera.
And what is the sort of fundamental advice you give to people, entrepreneurs? I mean, obviously that is your profession, so there's a lot of depth to it. But if you're going to give a high level overview, which I think you have, what was the name of the book that's on Amazon right now? Besides Between Two Worlds, there's another one.
The Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together.
That's the one. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, it always, I think all like blanket advice sounds a little bit trite, but
of course.
I really begin with
and just as a total sidebar, like that's why I hate so much of like social media, which is just everybody telling you how to live your life.
The sound like, bite. Yeah.
Even books, like in-depth books, it's like, unless it's an everyday kind of practice and you're in it and doing it, it's like it all kind of falls to the sidelines. And maybe like there's like the 1% like thing, and like maybe with enough 1% changes, you'll actually materially, but total sidebar. So I understand what you're saying. Yeah. It sounds trite because in many ways it is in fact, but it's still a starting point. And, and I think that's where it matters. So sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, no, I think my starting point is the really deep acknowledgement that this is very difficult. It's difficult in ways that you don't expect. It's difficult for you. It's difficult for your family. It's difficult on your body. It's difficult on your health. So let's tell the truth about that. And then let's find the things that tether you to your well-being. So relationships, hobbies, ways of working, like that's where all the like unique strategy and specific tactics for people's lives, whether it's their morning routine or their, what are they, cold plunge or not, like psychedelics or not, that's the like magic sort of secret potion for everyone. But the premise is this is hard. You're going to need a tether to your own self. So what is that? How do we put it together?
Right. There you have it, folks. Entrepreneurship sucks. From a clinical psychologist.
Well, it is also awesome, right? Astronauts need a tether when they go on a spacewalk. Like, if you're out there on the edges of the universe, you need a map back.
I think it's a really important point, actually, because like we glorify hustle culture, and I'm hoping that changes. But like everyone thinks, like being an entrepreneur is this glorious thing, and there are certainly wonderful aspects of it. There's no doubt about that. But it's fucking hard. And then on the flip side, you know, where we were, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes of the conversation is that no one wants to acknowledge that these people, you know, of success, because we're only talking about entrepreneurs very often who have either had massive success or massive failures, but usually massive success. Like they're not given permission to be like, no, that was really fucking hard and it destroyed my life. And people are like, oh, boo hoo, look how successful you are. And it's like, I think that's an important acknowledgement to say like, this is really, really, really hard. Not just in like the sheer amount of work you have to put in, but there's going to be emotional challenges. It's going to stretch your identity. It's going to challenge your values. It's not easy.
And can we please give people permission to be in the space that they're in, period?
Yeah. What's that? That's a mic drop moment. All right. Let's talk about Between Two Worlds.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about the backdrop. I know the backstory, but why don't you share it with us? And I don't know if inspired is the right word, but inspired you to write the book.
Yeah. So it's an interesting thing to be a clinical psychologist who's supposed to be really great at helping people find the tether back to their own selves. And, to deeply love someone who loses that battle. So my more recent book, Touching Two Worlds, is about the loss of my brother to suicide, which came on the heels of the loss of my dad to cancer. So I guess I could be one of those people where if you look at me and you look at my life and my beautiful children, it just looks like everything's picture perfect. But underneath that is, of course, just deep grief and loss and it felt really important for me, for my own heart and sanity, to just write about what was happening in this unraveling of my family and life. And that eventually became a book. One, to be quite honest, that I'm really proud of. Like, there's a lot of my heart in this book. And I don't know that I don't know that grief is a very sexy topic. I don't know that it's a place that people want to traverse, but it is a universal experience. Like we all are going to be in the front row at that funeral one way or another. So I think helping folks get a little more comfortable in that very uncomfortable spot is an important part of my work right now.
And so I've done a couple of conversations about grief, one with BJ Miller. I don't know if you know BJ, but he's a physician. And when he was in university, he got electrocuted doing something dumb, almost died, lost limbs. Like it was a pretty traumatic experience, obviously. And more recently with my cousin, Mira Atlin Stein, whose husband, you know, died from cancer. And she's my age. And what was particularly terrifying and uncomfortable for me is her eldest child is this, her child is the same age as my eldest child. And I'm like, and I, as a good Jewish hypochondriac, watching all of that unfold kind of live on Facebook terrified the shit out of me. And so she came on and talked about her experience with grief and what that experience helped her to understand. So I'm very curious about what you've come to understand about grief through, you know, these very, very real and very traumatic and very sad experiences.
Well, something that may surprise your listeners and maybe you is that I have found tremendous relief from my grief by becoming a circus artist.
Right.
So that's a little bit of a unexpected left turn, but it's very profoundly true for me in that my grief needed to be embodied. And when I felt most unable to process cognitively what was happening, I could just get in my body, be on a flying trapeze. And the only thing that's happening for me in that moment is my focus on holding on, not falling, staying alive myself, which is its own profound practice, is in the face of significant death, practicing your aliveness became a bit of a mantra for me in finding my way back from the depths of the story. You know, my brother's unraveling was long and fast at the same time, but lots of rounds of treatment and calls from the emergency room and me rushing over in the middle of the night to clean up blood and just like had a lot of trauma in it to just love him and show up for him. And I think in the process of me being in those places, found myself so close and intimate to death. My, you know, my dad died in my arms. My brother didn't, I wasn't with my brother when he died, but like there was just this intimacy with death that I needed a really big energetic counterbalance to that. And that became through this sort of joyful, playful movement practice.
With respect to your brother, you know, that's, how did you not lose yourself in that process? Right. Cause like, you know, I'm sure I'm putting words in your mouth, but I'm sure there's a lot of anger, like having to constantly pick up the pieces from that. Like even before, you know, he made the ultimate decision, there was a lot of shit you had to deal with, right? And you know, when dealing with, and that's a conversation we haven't explored, but with dealing with people who have mental health issues, it's like you try to have compassion, but God, there's going to be a lot of anger and hurt and sorrow and frustration and all that kind of shit that I imagine most people would try to swallow down, because it's like, oh, I'm not the one dealing with the mental health issue. And did you find, how did you approach all of those emotions?
I think there was a roller coaster. I mean, one thing that was helpful is I did have, I had young children at home. So there were some clear limits to what I could meaningfully do. And so, you know, my husband and I had a pretty good conversation as this began to unravel about what we would and could do. So we had some boundaries. Like, I never ever wanted him to be hungry. I never ever wanted him to be on the street. I never ever wanted him to be, where he couldn't make a phone call or get in touch with me. But also we didn't house him. We didn't bring him into our home and sort of nurse him back. Like, we just didn't feel like that was a good idea with our young kids. And so there were, it was a nuanced conversation, but it was also quite boundaried and clear what my yeses were and what my noes were. And mostly I feel good about that, right? There are a few times where I think maybe I missed it or I could have like infused a little bit of extra love, and maybe that would have made a difference in the story. But generally speaking, like, I loved him as well as I could, and also tried not to completely lose myself or my family in that process.
Yeah. One of the things that Mira said going through her experience, and I'm curious to know your thoughts about it, but if I was going to sum up the conversation, which was a beautiful conversation in a single sentence, even if it's trite to try and sum that up in a mm-hmm. single sentence, but she's like, let yourself fall apart. Like, yeah. That is absolutely the key. Don't let anyone tell you to, like, yeah. keep a chin up or things will get better. Just fall the fuck apart and be yeah. okay with that. And I'm wondering how that lands.
Yeah. For you. Oh, I love that. I think that's very resonant. Kind of going back to the earlier part of our conversation, talking about our, like, avoidance of the depths. I mean, people who have lost someone significant, if they're traditionally employed, they get 1 or 2, maybe 5 days of bereavement leaves. The expectation of our culture is like, have the service, clean out the stuff, and get your ass back to work. Be productive. Let's go. Yeah. And, oh, it's such an affront to the soul to not have the space to say, I am, like, broken. I write in my book around, like, the value of, like, wearing a black armband or something that says to the outside world, I'm in heartbreak. Like, do not fuck with me. Like, I cannot handle the world. And I had this breaking point around the librarian at my kid's school was, like, out for blood because one of my kids lost a book called Dog Man. And I was getting just, like, repeated emails about this stupid book. And I was just like, I cannot fucking show up for any of this. I do not care. But there's just a void in our societal capacity to say no in grief, not home right now, leave me alone. So giving yourself permission to be in a mess, to not get things done, to fall apart, to cry, feels like so important and so healthy. And what I really want other people to remember in their own grief.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I was watching your TEDx talk before I coughed. You know, one of the things that, and for everyone listening, Sherry did a TEDx talk at Breckenridge, you know, about this topic and how finding the circus, even though that's an injustice, I think, to it, but helped with the grieving process. One of the things that came up for me is last year, just about a year ago, actually, I had the privilege of doing a workshop with Dr. Gita Vaid and Bessel van der Kolk and mm-hmm. Misha Sky, doing ketamine-assisted therapy with psychodrama. And one of the participants, Mariah, she, during one of her ketamine experiences, came out, and I'm attributing it to her. I may be misremembering exactly what happened, but she said she had this awareness that, you know, telling children to use their words is such an affront to childhood because mm-hmm. emotions are so much bigger than words. And so many of our struggles emotionally is that we try and, language is the medium of the mind for sure. And we try and take these very complex, and Alan Watts talks about this, these very complex concepts and put them into words, which are naturally imperfect. And so to tell a child to use your words means taking something really big and tense and emotional and try and squeeze it into something that can be expressed, even though, you know, just that process of squeezing it into a word diminishes the intensity of what they may be feeling mm-hmm. at the moment. And, you know,
I think it's the same violence we do to grownups when we really offer mental health services through face-to-face conversation. I mean, that's our default way of saying, oh, something difficult and painful has happened to you. Let's talk about it. And I love language. I love words. I've written a couple of books. Like, I live in that space, but oh my God, it's not native language to a lot of people. And it's not the native language of emotion. I mean, the native language of emotion is embodied. It's flop yourself on the floor. It's pound. It's wail. It's make noise. It's breathe. It's your heartbeat and your muscle shift. Like, our emotion lives in our bodies. And we have told ourselves this story that we have to process, like package it up really nicely into these like prefrontal cortex processes called words. And that's how we heal. And that's how we make sense. And I think that's just like, that's the end of the story. The beginning of the story is feeling and experiencing and holding and releasing and like all of these big things that happen in our bodies. And then maybe we'll get to the words, but that might not even be very important. And it's a similar process in the psychedelic story. Like, we're working at a place underneath words often when we're working in a non-ordinary state experience. The words are helpful because they're the bridge between the humans, but they're not where the meat of the healing is happening. So whether it's psychedelics or circus, like, I just have a whole different relationship with what that process looks like now that I've gone through it myself.
Did you have any concern? I mean, it's hard to probably say in the moment and even speaking about yourself, but I see a lot of people using fitness as a bypass. You know, for intent, like, it is a way to get part of it out, but it's also a way to avoid having to deal with it. Right. But did that ever cross your mind that maybe I'm just avoiding my pain through this? Or how did you know that this was helping you and not avoidance?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I appreciate the like acknowledgement to sort of trading one pain for just another sensory experience that's all encompassing and can just cover over the other thing. I think folk do that a lot. You know, I think for me, there was a pretty healthy balance of things. Like, again, I was writing a lot. This book is essentially like the polished, published version of my journals. So I was still in words. I was still in my sort of, prefrontal brain. I was in therapy. I was doing some journey work. Like, it was a whole package of things that helped me to stay tethered to myself and to my life and to the planet. It wasn't just one thing, but I do think there's something super magical about circus in particular, because it's artist athlete. Like, it's not just like lifting weights. It's also crafting an emotional narrative and an experience through your body. So akin to the psychodrama work that you did with Bustle, you're doing something with your body that's telling a story, not just cardio or lifting weights. So there's a little bit of that emotional expression part too.
That's very cool. There's also something about it that's like the circus is absurd, right?
And, yes.
You know, and just paying homage to the absurdity of life sometimes, you know, not to diminish at all the intensity and grief, but it's like, it helps you take a step back and just be a reminder that like, shit, this is life, right? Yeah. Like, let's it all of it. Like Tom Robbins, give me a life, all of life, the miserable as well as the superb. And so I think there's a beautiful piece of it being the circus too, that, gives
when you've been on the edges when you've been on the edges of life in the pain part, you might as well go to the edges of life in the silly part or the joyful part or the blissful part. Like, you know, you already swung the pendulum so far over. Just let it swing back too.
Do you have any views on like afterlife and anything along those lines? Like, how much does spirituality play into your experience? And what did you, has that shifted as a result of this experience?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a very evangelical Christian community. So there was a lot of articulated theology around exactly what happened and where you're going and what the architecture's like. You know, we got pearly gates and gold streets and all kinds of things. And, you know, I grew up singing songs about this. And I also grew up with a mom who had a disability. She had MS. And so okay. She had a very clear sense of like, when I get to heaven, I'll be able to dance and run. Like there will be an embodied life for me after this whole story is done. Yeah. And so that theology was really a primary part of my upbringing, but it really didn't land at all when these people that I loved really died. I'd had no sense of them going somewhere. I had no sense of comfort that they were like out there somewhere playing fetch with my childhood dog who died when I was in fifth grade. Like it just didn't resonate. It didn't land. It didn't feel true. It didn't matter to me. It wasn't important. The places that I've felt most connected to, I guess, the potential existence of my dad and brother, outside of their embodied experience on the planet. One is it actually in my own body, sort of in the circus. You know, I have these broad, really muscular shoulders and I have blue eyes, and those are absolutely from my dad. I have my dad's eyes and my dad's like muscular build. And so that sense of continuity of his body and my body and the way that that sort of cellular material has passed from him to me and on. And then I feel really connected to the places on the planet that my dad and brother loved. So I live in Minnesota and everybody's got a lake here. That's just one of the perks of living in Minnesota. So the lake outside my house is a place both my dad and brother spent time and traveled and paddleboarded. And I feel a communion with them when I'm in places that they loved and when we're sort of sharing in the same experience of natural beauty. I don't know that they're there. I don't know that they're floating around watching or guiding or any of that stuff. I don't know about the ancestors, like, but I know that I just feel connected to them in certain moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's B.J. Miller talks about grief as being a transformational energy, I think is the way he described it, which is like letting go of the physical, but converting it into the emotional. Mm-hmm. So like that process is what grief is. And so in many ways, we should look forward to grieving because it's the way we change connections from one piece to another, right? Yeah. It's a powerful, beautiful process. And, you know, I think there's a lot of that in what you just said.
There is a lot of love in grief, which I think surprised me. I mean, it feels like love that's just still alive, that's ongoing. And of course there's sadness and there's anger and there's fear. And it's a very powerful packed cocktail of feelings. But I'm grateful for the love part.
You talked about the word ancestors, and I'm curious to know about what your experiences with psychedelics have been and what they've revealed to you. Like, Steph just got back from doing a retreat at Holos in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. And during one of her experiences, she went to the level of the ancestors. And, mm-hmm. you know, those experiences are very real. And
yeah.
Like, sure, you know, cynics could be like, well, that's just the drugs. But, you know, at the end of the day, the drugs can't make your biology do anything, right? At the end of the day, yeah. It's still your biology that is having that experience. And the drugs are just a catalyst, but not the causation. So I'm curious to know where your exploration with psychedelics have gone and what they've helped reveal to you.
Yeah. I think they've been amazing tools in my grief, in my capacity for love, in my supporting of others and their healing. I've certainly done some work to try to, you know, be present to ancestors or connect to those experiences that are bigger than, greater than, that supersede my collection of cells. And I think that's, you know, whether we want to play science with it, we can look at the work coming out of Johns Hopkins that points to the primacy of spiritual experience and the efficacy of that psychedelic healing is about really that knowing on a cellular level that there's a bigger story happening outside of the container of your skin. And whether we can sort of point to ancestors or we have a language for that, there's just a knowing. And there's great comfort in that, I think, for most of us who enter those spaces.
Yeah. And I think I was just speaking to someone yesterday and telling the story about how at Field Trip, even though we were notionally a mental health company, for me, it was all about trying to help people explore their consciousness, right?
Like, yeah.
Exploring your consciousness, the default effect, I believe, will be an enhancement in mental health, because my guess is a lot of our mental health issues have become a result of disconnection from ourselves and disconnection from, you know, something bigger.
Spirit,
and,
source, whatever. Spirit,
yeah, whatever. Yeah, whatever, you know. And I was telling a story about how there was a reporter, I think she was from Popular Mechanics, and she did a session at Field Trip and then reported on it. But she was telling me in the conversation afterwards that, like, coming out of the ketamine experience, she like looked at her hands and she was just like in awe. She used those words of her hands. And I'm like, that's it, right? To me, that's it. It's like reconnecting to the mystery, the awe, or even like the absurd, right? Like, just like how ridiculous on a conscious level that all of that can seem, but like, it feels really, really important for us to, as beings, to have some of that in our lives.
Yeah.
And like, our over-indexing on science and the rational mind is probably, you know, directly contributory to the whole mental health crisis that we have, because we've lost so much connection to that mystery. It's an important part
beauty,
of this conversation.
You know, beauty as fuel for our experience. You know, I think whether it's grief or psychedelics, like, when things crack us open, we see both the blood and guts and the mess, but then we also see some of the mastery in our own beauty, the beauty around us. And I think most people who have done a lot of work in psychedelics feel quite opened up to be able to see the beauty in all sorts of stories and all sorts of scenes, and to realize that as fuel, as juice that takes us through this embodied existence.
It's interesting that it just popped into my mind, but why is it the nature of the human experience that we need to tap into things like beauty and awe? You know, I saw a post, I think it was a quote, can't remember from what it was, but it was essentially like, humans are the only organisms who spend all of their time thinking about the why of life as opposed to living it. You know, you look at dogs and they don't need a sense of beauty. Maybe they do. Maybe
my dog thinks I'm beautiful. I'm sure of it.
I'm sure it does. I'm not sure my dog does, but he sure likes to give hugs. But yeah, it is interesting why that seems to be part of the human experience. But then I go back to Alan Watts, and like, that's just the nature of having, I won't call it an evolved, but an expanded consciousness, that you take the good with the bad. And so the capacity to experience more on the positive side comes necessarily with the capacity to experience more on, we'll call it, the negative side, even though it's probably not an appropriate term.
Well, with that creative drive comes the destructive drive. Like, Freud sort of
really good at
ideas of eros, libido, and thanatos, like these core human drivers that are like, let's make, let's create, let's be in bliss, let's be in sex, let's get in there. And then also, like, let's tear shit apart, let's kill, let's like maim, you know? And we have this, not to misuse this term, but a little bit of like a bipolar drive within us that, again, on one hand, is that creative drive. It's like, I want to make something. I want the world to be impacted by my existence here on the planet. I want to leave a business. I want to leave a baby, a garden, a something that says, I was here and I did shit. And look at this. It's great. And that I feel like is the beauty drive, the creation drive. And when we tap into beauty, whether it's natural beauty or the beauty of consciousness, the beauty of other humans, it fuels our capacity to make beauty ourselves. But then also, of course, is within us that destructive drive and the destruction of being able to fall into grief, fall into the abyss, fall into the falling apart of ourselves, and not always know how to get out.
Sometimes I wish our desire, at least my desire, to leave my mark on the world was no more informed than banjos, and I could just pee on everything and be very content with that.
You could do that experiment. I think you should write that book. Like, doing this for a year. I'm making my mark through urine, and I will
leaving my mark reflect on the world. And see how people respond. I think.
I mean, maybe you'll get to come back as like a puppy next round. I don't know.
Maybe. Or, you know, if you really dive into it, all of time is happening. All of our lifetimes are happening simultaneously. So that is happening right now. I just need to tap into that side of me a little bit more.
Are you peeing right now, Ronan?
I have too much performance anxiety to do that. But maybe I'll work on that. But they also, to the other point, it was just like, you know, again, yin and yang is such a cliche thing to talk about, but it does feel like, you know, the cost of creativity is destruction, like creative destruction. You need to build over the old to create the new. That's just the nature of it. And so it all goes hand in hand, yin and yang, black and white, all that kind of good stuff. And, it's just sometimes hard to reconcile it all when you get stuck in the middle of it.
I love humans. I love watching the drama unfold, right? I mean, even in the darkness of it, like my brother struggled to try to figure out how to stay, how to like ground himself into this planet without numbing or feeling an addiction or feeling lost. Like, and I'm so fucking proud of him for the struggle. He lost, I guess we would say, he's not here anymore, but like, what a valiant effort. And I think when we are awake to it, there's all kinds of heroism happening all around us, you know, in parents who are like, I'm end of the day tired, I got no steam left, but yes, I will scoop that kid up and I will read Goodnight Moon for the 18th time and we will do it again because I'm showing up in love. And I love the entrepreneurs who are like, oh my God, I don't know how to make this work anymore. Or maybe it's not working and I have to say goodbye to it, but I'll probably try again. I'll probably do something again. I'm going to jump in the arena again. So I feel like I have the best job in the world because I get to really see behind the curtain in people's struggles. And in that struggle, there's a ton of beauty and delight and things to just celebrate and cheer for.
That's beautiful. I was going to ask.
I'm glad I'm a human.
I think I want to end this conversation on that beautiful note, but it reminds me of a couple of years ago, there was, I think it was from The Oatmeal, where they're talking about the different levels of consciousness and how, you know, base level of consciousness when you're at the fast food restaurant and the snotty-nosed kid is giving you an attitude when you're ordering your burgers and you just want to reach across the counter and punch them out. That's like base level consciousness. And then there's the higher level of consciousness where you go into that moment and instead of wanting to punch that kid out, you have the experience of, I wonder what's going on with them. I wonder why they're in that mood today. What I don't know anything about their lives. Maybe they're struggling with something and I should be a little bit more patient. And then there's the highest level of consciousness as they described it, which was the awareness that like, shit, I'm on this earth and this is amazing. And I get to eat food and just the fact that I exist is super cool. And what you were talking about kind of sat in the in-between between probably 2 and 3 and just looking across and not only having compassion, for the kid who's given you attitude, but also having an immense amount of awe and gratitude for just the experience of being human and getting to experience, you know, other humans and all of what they bring to this world. And it's all part of the grand scheme of things. And it's just really nice.
The joy of that human story.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Being here for it.
And what else did we talk about when I failed to hit record besides getting what you're working on and what you're doing? Is there anything else in between?
I think that's it.
This is the problem with 40-year-old plus brains. How old are you?
I'm 45. Am I 45? I think I'm 45 still. 78? I don't know. Yeah, 78.
Okay.
Yeah, 45.
You're 45.
Okay, halfway through.
Yeah. So right in the middle of, there's the midlife crisis, there's the midlife awakening, and then there's the midlife forget just about everything you know that happens to all of us because your memory goes to shit somewhere around now. Maybe it's part of having kids. I don't know, but it sure seems to be.
Or COVID in your case.
Yeah, no, I can't blame COVID because this is most days of my life, even COVID unrelated. But please, is there anything else you wanted to share about what you're doing and what people should be looking to you for?
Yeah, just if people are curious about my work, I spend a lot of time working one-on-one with entrepreneurs and high performers and sort of helping through the hard things. Do some psychedelic work as well. And I also make circuses, which is sort of a funny thing to be doing. But every May, I do a circus that's focused on mental health or some component of consciousness and invite artists to come and use their bodies as storytelling tools and help people really sort of like edutainment. I think that's a word that's sort of a dumb word, but in any event, it's both educational and entertaining and beautiful and feels like a fun and important part of my world. So people can follow me on Instagram if they're curious about that. I have a newsletter, I have books, I have, like, you know, you can stalk me on the internet. There's a lot of information out there.
And
happy to be of service to the human experience.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I will make sure to link all of your stuff in the show notes so people can find it easily. And I will say this because I said it before when we weren't recording, but I strongly encourage you to offer psychedelics during the circus experience because referencing the immortality key and what happened in ancient Greece and how they took psychedelics and were witness to a performance and how it convinced people that there is life beyond life and that if you die before you die, you don't die when you die. Maybe there's an element of that in Sherry's circus with a little bit of psychedelics. Maybe, just maybe.
I don't think we're going to put that on the website, but.
And that's not medical or clinical advice. It's just a really fucking good idea. Anyway, thank you, Sherry, so much. I really appreciated the conversation. And I was very sincere where I'm very grateful for spending the time and for the energy you're putting into the world. Beyond the words, the energy I think is super important. And I'm really grateful that you're doing it.
My pleasure. Thanks for the conversation, Ronan.
Of course. Have a great day.